New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Quick note, I'm conducting a four-part seminar series with Leslie Keen, Danny Sheehan, James Tunney, and Alan Cohen called One Step Beyond, How the Paranormal is Changing Religion and Our Own Spirituality. For more information on that, go to ChristopherNaughton.com. Hello, I'm Christopher Naughton. I'm happy to be working alongside longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Badness, and all the great guest hosts here at New Thinking Aloud. Quick reminder right here at the top. Please click on like, comment, subscribe, ring the bell. It helps get programs like these out to people like you. Well, you could argue that they were the biggest cultural phenomenon of the past century. But whether you believe that or not, the Beatles had an indelible impact, not only on pop culture, but on our beliefs and consciousness. My guest today is Joanne DiMaggio. She's a researcher, teacher, and past life therapist, and also the author of numerous books, including Soul Writing, Conversations with Our Higher Self, and her latest is The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. She joins us today from her home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Joanne, thank you for joining me today. It's a great pleasure to have you here again on New Thinking Aloud.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
My question for you is, you know, how does a nice young Catholic girl from South Side of Chicago get plugged into the Beatles and esoteric philosophies? And, you know, what's the common ground between the two of them?
Well, that was my question, which is why I wrote the book, because I couldn't figure it out for the longest time. I was wondering, you know, what happened during those formative years? I knew I was passionate about reincarnation at one point, and then I was passionate about the Beatles. And then when the Beatles ended, I became passionate about reincarnation again. And I thought, you know, is there some connection here between the two? And so that put me on this long journey of kind of going back in time and looking back at all of my, everything I wrote, all the newsletters that I had when I was president of that Beatles fan club, to get some tips, some hints that maybe the seed was planted in back in the 60s and it didn't really flourish until the late 80s. So it was a journey for sure.
Everyone in our generation, Joanne, remembers this. Can you recall the excitement in February of 1964 when the Beatles first hit the stage at Ed Sullivan? You can't miss the excitement. You can't miss the exuberance. You can't miss the energy, the youthfulness, maybe even the sexuality. I mean, there is a force there that had to be reckoned with. I think it surpassed how fans, you know, reacted to Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra. This was a worldwide phenomenon. And I would say it impacted men and women, but women really plugged in. You could just hear the screens are predominantly young girls in that audience.
Yeah, I don't think we really knew why we were screaming. I looked into it a little bit further and thought about it deeper than that. But I think that that excitement was just so contagious that it just overtook us, and we had to express ourselves. I didn't scream so much as I did as I was a crier. So it was like I was just
But it affected you emotionally.
Emotionally put me in a whole different world. Absolutely, yeah.
You know, it's interesting, of course, this is just months when they come in February 64. This is just months after the assassination of JFK. And I don't know how you can't make the connection here. A young, vibrant president is shot down in the prime of his life, very progressive a very liberal, very open-minded, very forward-thinking president, there's this real void. And I think you say in your book, The Inner Light, that the void of JFK, youth movement of the time, were also undergoing a spiritual crisis. Right. Explain that.
Right. I think a lot of us were questioning just about everything going on in our lives and in the world. I know, I remember the moment that they announced that JFK had been killed, and it was, even my mother made a comment about the fact that I took it so hard. She said, you've taken it harder than when a relative has died. And I think it's because, especially in our generation, we had a lot of hope in excitement and anticipation of worldwide change with the Kennedys. And there was just something very magical about them. And I think that when that was taken away from us in such a brutal way, it really, it just drained us. It put a hole in us. And so, yeah, a couple of months later, here come the Beatles, and they filled that hole. It's like, you know, I have a chapter called Fixing the Hole. That's really what it was about. It was about lifting us out of those that depression that we were in, and giving us something else to think about. And so our days were filled with their music, and their music was happy. They weren't writing anything at that point in time that would drag you down. So we were all happy, jumping around, dancing, and it really brought us out of that, the doldrums that we had fallen into, and we really couldn't get enough of them.
You know, another thing going on at the time, too, was that this, you know, JFK was one of the first presidents, maybe the first president, who started to promote the Voting Rights Act and racial equality. I mean, look, we had that since Lincoln, but no one in modern times in the 20th century had been so active in that area. And of course, it was LBJ who came after Kennedy, who really completed the mission. But isn't it interesting that we eschewed or deflected black music in this country, but when the Beatles take our black music and our R&B, and then they come back around in their mop tops and white faces, if pardon me, but that's the truth. Isn't it interesting that this is not only a spiritual, but maybe even a racial divide that's being bridged?
Yeah. There was certainly a lot going on in the 60s that we were trying to wrap around our heads. I came from a very, very bigoted family. I will admit that. And my dad was a truck driver on the south side of Chicago. And when he would come home at night, like I think I wrote in one of my books, he would just sort of spill his venom all over the pot roast that my mother had made about his hatred, you know, for certain racial groups, let's say. I grew up in a very segregated neighborhood. I never even saw an African American until I don't know how old I was, 6 or 7. The way I was raised and what was kind of going on within my family and with the families that were in the neighborhood that I lived in. Yeah, I mean, we really didn't have an introduction to that music until the Beatles came along. And I think that was part of the reason that the adults, many adults hated it, because they recognized that. And but we loved it. We couldn't get enough of it. Well, we were too young. We weren't thinking in terms of, you know, what was going on culturally or within society at the time. So, but I do agree with you 100% that it really made a great shift and at the right time too.
And so much so, again, you become a president of a local fan club, but you end up being part of that fan club and expanded upon that. You were with them for 8 years. That's longer than the Beatles list from 64 on. I mean, at least. Beatles had been, you know, been around in Hamburg and in England, but you're part of the fan club from 64 to 72, and the Beatles had already said goodnight as a band, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Apple Records was still there, but so you stuck around for those 8 years.
I did. And there were many a time when I thought to myself, you know, I've got to get out of this because, I mean, I was being pressured at home. My dad said, you're too old to be doing this. You know, so it was my entire high school years. And then it was into my college years. And the club kept evolving. So it you know, if you notice in the book, I talk about how many times I changed the name of it. And I was doing this newsletter and really honing in on some skills that would serve me well later on in life. But there was a lot of conflict going on within the club, also within the group, within the Beatles themselves. We were reflecting that conflict. So when they weren't getting along, we as fans weren't getting along. And I was getting a really hard lesson in conflict resolution, you know, at a young age when I really didn't know how to handle some of the hate mail that I was getting, some of the pushback I was getting. I mean, I write about, you know, at one point the club in the Beatles USA Limited, which became the official Beatles fan club, was headquartered in New York. They were under the auspices of Apple Records. So they were the national club. And at one point they wanted all the independent clubs to become part of them. So that led me into this great David and Goliath kind of conflict with them, because I didn't want my club to become part of that club. There was a lot to it, obviously. I engaged the help of a local disc jockey. But eventually I got worn down to, there were about 100 fan clubs in the country at the time. And at the end, three of us were the last of the holdouts. And so I think,
and in some ways you were fighting the same kind of battle in some ways that Paul McCartney was fighting, because after Brian Epstein dies, Alan Klein, who is this big burly New York businessman who also managed the Rolling Stones, comes along with an iron fist, and he basically wants to put everybody under one roof, if not crush you.
Exactly. And Alan Klein did not like the fan clubs. He absolutely was antagonistic toward the fan clubs. And so they were operating, the gals in the office that were operating the fan club were pretty much autonomous. I think that they were under instructions like, go do whatever you want to do and don't bother us, meaning the people upstairs. And so, it was for me, they sweetened the pot. And I guess because I had engaged Jim Stagg from the WCFL to help out, they thought we better keep her under our thumb. And so they said, hey, Julian, how about if we make you national chapter director? And I go, what's that? And they said, you would be in charge of all the chapters in the whole country. They'd all have to report to you, be the liaison. And I thought, well, you know what? I could look out for their interests because I'm one of them. Right. Mm-hmm. So it had some perks to it. I got a check from Apple for $25 a month. So I could say I'm on Apple's payroll because here's my check to prove it. And there were advantages to being part of the National Club. We would get original photographs. We would get the news a lot sooner. You have to remember, back then, there was no internet. You know, we got all of our news from the local radio stations, the newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. We did not, we couldn't just plug in to the internet and type something in and then get all this information. And some of my members were complaining that my information was old. And they said, you know, if you join the National Club, it would be, you know, more up to date. So I thought, okay, it's enough for me to give it a whirl. So I agreed to that and became national chapter director. And then simultaneously with that, they were forming individual clubs for individual Beatles. And so the Paul McCartney fan club was available, and I took that one over.
Well, since your story is largely a spiritual story and it becomes very esoteric at some point for, again, a young Catholic girl from the south side of Chicago, but I love what you say in the book about, you know, because when I read the book, you know, your experiences as a fan club and fan club director, there were a lot of spiritual lessons that you were going through as well. And I love what you said. It would take me many years to understand that devoting yourself to something you deeply believe in without any expectation of reward or recognition is a form of unconditional love.
Exactly. Yeah. I think on some level, on some subliminal level, I did expect something back. I was doing all this work and I really devoted my entire life. I had no social life. So while my friends were going out on dates and doing all that, I was in my basement pounding out newsletters on my mother's old Underwood typewriter and writing letters and forming meetings and stuff like that. So I was working so hard. I mean, every waking moment for all those years was dedicated to the Beatles. And I never wanted to meet them because I was very insecure and they intimidated me. And I was terrified. I thought, gee, Joanne, you did all this work all these years. If you meet them and they don't like you or they say something negative, it'll destroy you. It'll just destroy you. So to avoid that, I just kept a very low profile. And I'm still that way kind of to this day. So this is interesting that I even wrote this book. But that was for me, it was a real coming of age kind of story. When I really looked back on it and I realized, you know, if I really truly loved them and loved the work that I was doing and really believed in this whole idea of networking, then I wouldn't expect anything in return because that's, you know, I'm doing something that I'm sort of, my soul is programmed to do. And that's really part of the whole lesson about unconditional love. But I didn't figure that out at that young age.
No, and you did get something much, much greater back in return because you would not end up working with soul writing and past life regression theory and therapy, I should say, and interest in reincarnation and all things esoteric until you go back over some things dealing with the Beatles. Because in my estimation, the Beatles were always one step ahead of the culture. Here they burst out of the gate with their skinny ties and their black suits and their mop tops, and the exuberance and the passion is unparalleled. And then while other bands are catching up, they decide, wait, we're going to stop touring. We're going to go into the laboratory of the studio and we're going to ditch the black and white and the mop tops. And we're going to become multicolored wizards and we'll engage in lysergics and other hallucinogens and see and expose one another to other worlds. And while the rest of the rock world is catching up and, you know, they're taking their LSD, the Beatles now have already jumped off of that ship. And now they've taken us into the world of meditation and Eastern mysticism and spirituality. And so whether you were conscious of it or not, you were on that journey with them as so many of us were, but you more intimately than us.
Yeah. Well, I always thought Beatle fans were like little sponges. You know, we were so totally dedicated and so involved that anything and everything that they did or said, I mean, and a lot of it we didn't understand expanded. But we, you know, we took it in. So as they were going through these different changes, you could see the fan base was shifting a little bit as well. And so sometimes, you know, we would lose people, like, you know, when John made a statement about being more popular than Jesus, we lost a lot of members because they said, we can't go there with them. When, you know, Paul admitted that he took LSD, we lost another batch of members. We can't go there with them. When they went to India and started studying with the Maharishi, same thing happened, you know. This is too far out. We can't do it. But there was a core base of fans who stuck with them no matter what. And I was in that group. So, yeah, we couldn't help but evolve because they were, you know, we were on the Beatles, you know, train and on the Magical Mystery Tour. And we just went with them. Yeah.
You know, a lot of folks, myself included, often look back in Beatles discography history and, you know, jumping off point for when they went from, you know, mop tops, if you will, to hallucinogenic explorers or explorers of the East, etc. Many people refer to Tomorrow Never Knows, which is the last song on the Revolver album. But before we get to that, you raised something really interesting, which I hadn't heard before. You believe that the song Rain, I think you said it was the first Beatles release that suggested new altered states of consciousness. And what you say here, Joanne, is it's not just in the lyric, but in the music itself. In some ways, I think you're suggesting this is a forerunner to Tomorrow Never Knows. This is a forerunner to Sgt. Pepper. What was different about that, do you think, that made you say, we're going in a much different direction?
Yeah, well, I didn't know this at the time, but later found out that John felt that this music represented how he felt when he was in this disoriented state. You know, he heard it. He heard like Eastern religious chants, and he found a sound that reflected his, what he said was his stone consciousness. We didn't mm-hmm. know that at the time, but that's what that what I have read since about how that came about. And so that was a completely different sound for us, obviously. And
yeah, there was backtracking in that. There were a cacophony of sounds coming in. The harmonies on Rain are just amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, Beach Boys level, Beatles level of harmonies. And I think, you know, the notion was this sounds a little bit like an Eastern religious chant mm-hmm. Coming in when Lennon had his headphones on. Yeah. So it really is a precursor to this song, Tomorrow Never Knows, last song on Revolver. That song, which has great spiritual import coming from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, actually quoted from a book by Metzner and Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, and others about the psychedelic experience. And this is not a George Harrison song. This is not coming from the shaman of the group. This is John Lennon.
John again.
Who's basically tracking the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Right. Yeah, he said that he wanted to create in words the sound that, like a suitable guide track of his LSD experience, basically. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. That's my favorite Beatles song.
Is it really?
It really is, yeah.
And was it back then? Yeah. Because it's one of those songs that, you know, you may not get or grasp right away, like a Helter Skelter or something that is somewhat chaotic, but what's going on in this song is multi-layered.
Well, when I talk about planting a seed, think about the words from that song, I'll play the game existence to the end of the beginning.
Mm.
That's reincarnation in a nutshell. Okay. And all the words to that piece, I would play it over and over and over because it was talking to me. It was saying something to me. You know, our generation, we were very, very fortunate in that the music that we had, and not just from the Beatles, but, you know, the Moody Blues, Simon and Garfunkel, there was a level of profoundness to it. It took you deeper into your soul and mm-hmm. made you think. And you could just lose yourself in it. You could, if you were feeling down or whatever, you'd go to your room and you'd sit there and you'd play it over and over again. And that's what this song was for me. So I thought, what does that mean? I'll play the game existence to the end of the beginning. Mm. What does that mean? Sure, that wasn't an original John Lennon lyric, but it was mm-hmm. The whole concept of it. And I knew that's where his head was. And so even before George got into all of this, John was sort of leading the way. I mean, they kind of went in a different direction later on. But initially, you know, John was the one experimenting with these sounds and looking for material, you know, that was a little deeper than I Want to Hold Your Hand. So it was really yes. important to us. Yeah.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying. Lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void. It is shining that you may see the meaning of within. It is being. Wow, that again is far past puppy love and romantic relationships of young teenagers, and not only of course reincarnation, which is beautifully cited here, but of course the whole notion of meditation about turning our minds off, and of course this is going to open up the door to Sergeant Pepper. Mm-hmm. And I want to get your reaction here because I love what you had to say in the book. But of course, this is the overtly spiritual song among several, perhaps, but certainly the most overtly spiritual tune on their perhaps greatest album ever, Sgt. Pepper. And this is the Harrison song, Within You, Without You. Joanne, you didn't like this song at the beginning. You love, you're a Beatles fan and you put on Sgt. Pepper, but you skipped that song every time.
I did. I admit it. I did. I didn't like the sound. I did not resonate to that sound whatsoever.
Well, you and I may have had some tough experiences in India, perhaps.
Because I think so.
I mean, I love the song now. But the whole Ravi Shankar and the Eastern, the tambour and that sort of thing, initially at least, didn't pull me in. In fact, if anything, it pushed me away.
It did. It did. And so the unfortunate part about that was that because I skipped over it, I didn't listen to the words. I missed those lyrics completely. It's a shame because they're beautiful. They just totally encapsulate what I believe in. But it took me a while. I don't know how I made the transition. I still to this day not crazy about that music, that sound. Mm-hmm. But I get past it because the words are just so deeply meaningful. And they very, very succinctly reflect the work that I'm doing now. And so, I think that was just an important introduction. And I started to pay attention to Mr. Harrison a little bit more after that.
Now, it was actually before that, chronologically, you're going to help me out here. This is the quote that got John Lennon in a lot of trouble, especially here in the States.
Yeah.
Christianity will go, Lennon said. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I am right and I will be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Jesus was all right, but his disciples, and I don't think he's talking about his immediate 12. I think he's talking about, Christians, Christianity and Christian churches were thick and ordinary. It's them twisting it that ruins it for me. So he got in a lot of trouble, especially here in the States and especially in the South. They ended up burning records.
Yeah, burning records, banning them. It was really horrendous what happened. But again, it's so common, still happens today. You take something out of context, he didn't mean it the way people took it. And I think that I didn't know what to do when this happened, because I was getting a ton of letters and people were quitting the fan club because of it. Now I'm raised Christian.
Right. You're Catholic, but are you a dyed in the wool Catholic there, or just because you never really were. I mean, you went along cause that's what your family did and you were expected to do that, part of your culture, but it's not like, oh yeah, I love the service. I love kneeling. I love, the catechism, that sort of thing. That was really never your bag.
No, I went
right?
12 years to Catholic school. And I had a lot of questions. A lot of it didn't make any sense to me. So I was always, as a child, even 7 years old, looking for answers and I wasn't getting them from anybody in the church. So no, I mean, as far as him saying about Christianity going and all of that, being more popular than Jesus, I knew what he meant. And I thought to myself, well, what am I going to do now? I'm president of this fan club. I have a soapbox in my newsletter. Should I get up there and say something? So I finally did. I did write an article defending him and saying, I knew this is what he really meant. And we were just hoping to write it out. And I know that they had to address it. They had to address it, ironically, at their the press conference they had in Chicago when they were on tour.
It's the first one, right? It was the first press conference after this statement.
Right, exactly. But even though they addressed it, it didn't really, in my opinion, didn't tap down the antagonism that was there, it just showed that people were very narrow-minded and were quick to judge. And I didn't think of it at the time that he was saying, okay, look elsewhere. don't look at Christianity anymore. Look outside the box. But in reality, that's what the Beatles did for us. And I've quoted some when I interviewed other Beatle fans for the book. There's a whole chapter in there in which I'm asking people, did they have any influence on your spiritual journey? And a lot of them said, yeah, they said it was okay to look outside the box. And these are people who are not necessarily Catholic, but, you know, other religious beliefs. And they, you know, it's like, it's okay. It's okay. So I felt like, thank you for giving me permission, because I didn't have permission up until that point. It was like, you believe what you're told and that's it. So yeah, that was a big breakthrough moment. And it was the first real crisis that I remember that we went through with the group. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a PR nightmare for them. And it was. So, but they, you know, greatness breaks through, and we managed to get past that.
I like what he said in the conference. You know, he said, if I had said television instead of Beatles, I might've gotten away with it. Also, he said, I don't know what's going to go first, rock and roll or Christianity. It might be a tie, because in some ways rock and roll has passed away or is on life support. And so is Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah, you might. Yeah, that's a very good observation. I agree with you. Totally. Yeah.
You know, the Beatles plugged into, you know, the whole notion of, and as I said before, they're always ahead of the crowd. And they were plugging into what was next. So, of course, they do go to India. They do meet up with the Maharishi. Harrison really, really plugs in. The others, I think, are impacted. They all meditated. But certainly John Lennon may have seen through the Maharishi sooner than George did, because he wrote Sexy Sadie on the White Album, which basically excoriates Maharishi for being, you know, interested, you know, sexually in some of the Beatles' wives and their entourage and that sort of thing. He was very much a human being as well. But the White Album, I think they basically created the White Album when they were there. Much of it was written there, right? When they were there in India.
And also, I think that if you take everything away from that time that they were there, you know, Ringo only lasted 2 weeks. And then he said, I've had enough of this. I'm going. Then Paul went somewhat right after that. John hung in there with George for a while longer. We had no idea that Sexy Sadie was about what it was about at the time. Mm-hmm. They did learn the transcendental meditation from the Maharishi. And if nothing else, that is something that they took with them many, many years. And to this day, I know that Paul still does the meditation. Mm-hmm. So if nothing else, if it had no other purpose than to do that, I mean, it had a much deeper meaning for George, obviously. Because I have this quote that I love that Rabbi Shankar said about George, that he was talking about how George was so immersed in Indian culture. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, and then how he wanted to learn how to play the sitar. And he goes, well, you know, that none of this makes any sense unless you believe in reincarnation. And of course, you know, that is obvious for George did believe that he had a past life there. So for him, it was a much more profound, deeper journey than the others. But the fact that they learned how to do the transcendental meditation and that they used it, that's the important thing. They used it. They continued to use it. I think that everything else can kind of fall by the wayside, because that's the tool. You know, throughout our lives, we're given tools here and there, different stages of our evolution. And that's the important tool they got out of that trip.
You know, George is very clear that now the drug phase is behind him. But I think for all of them, especially Harrison, but I think all of them were all impacted deeply by their use of hallucinogens and then their subsequent spiritual exploration.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were too. So, you know, following them along, listening to the music, the lyrics, especially George's, we're wondering, you know, wow, they're saying something to us. They're telling us something. They're pointing the way they're enlightening us, they're giving us more to think about. And we were open to it, obviously, and just went with it. And that's why I say I have always felt like they were planting seeds all along. And the seeds didn't exactly bloom immediately. Some of us, it took 10, 20 years before, you know, before they blossomed. And then suddenly we were reminded, I remember this before, you know, when I was a Beatles fan, I heard this, I was thinking these things back then, and then getting back into it. And in my case, you know, turning it into an entire career. So I think it had a tremendous, profound effect, and it still does. I am amazed at the young people. When I say young people, they're like, they were my like teenagers, you know. If you, some of the Facebook pages that they sound just like us. And I'm like, how could that be when there are no more Beatles around? So you guys are dealing with, you know, with, you know, there was a set number of songs that were done. You're not necessarily following it chronologically like we were, so that we know the stages of growth. But they're there alive and well. And that really makes me so full of joy to think that, that it's a legacy that is going to live on long after I'm gone and our generation is gone.
I always find this to be a great synchronicity or great piece of kismet, however you'd like to categorize it. But, you know, the first worldwide satellite transmission are the Beatles. How much more perfect could the first satellite transmission be people around the world could see the same image at the same time for the first time? Right. And it's the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. That's a statement right
there.
That
was so powerful. Yeah. Actually, I met a man who was there, was in the studio at the time and part of that group that were singing with them. So what a thrill that was. Yeah, I remember that. And I thought, wow, this is just so powerful. And it resonated, I think, on a very, very deep spiritual level. But the fact that it did go across the entire world, I think, you know, set the stage. I think it set really the stage, I think, for John as well, because, you know, his wanting to, you know, give peace a chance and all of that, and wanting to get that message out to everybody across the universe, I think is something that got its start there and with that song.
You know, I love what you bring up in the book of part of the Beatles process. I mean, you were able to merge what their deeper beliefs were, their deeper spiritual beliefs were, with their process sometimes. And I love what you said about a number of songs, Nowhere Man, Across the Universe, Yesterday. These are almost all stream of consciousness songs, or they come as a result of stream of consciousness, whether it's through a dream, meditation, or it becomes, you know, like a thief in the night, something that is like a lightning bolt. And all of a sudden they are compelled to write and they can't stop writing and they just need to get it out. That was a really interesting look at their process, occasionally, not always.
Yeah. That was happening sort of later on. And what absolutely astounded me when I was doing the research on the book was that's the process you use for soul writing. Soul writing is a written form of meditation. So I tell people, you know, if you think of prayer as you talking to God and meditation as God talking to you, soul writing is you taking notes. So you're downloading. The information is coming from above, coming through you, and out your soul, down your arm, out your hand. So in very great composers and artists and writers over centuries have been asked, you know, where does your inspiration come from? And they have a hard time defining it, but they all say the same thing. It feels as though it's coming through dictation. It's like it's
being channeled.
Like it's being channeled, exactly. You know, so Mozart's not going to use the word channeled, and neither is Beethoven. Right. But, you know, that's exactly what it is. And so when I read about Across the Universe, which is another one of my favorite Beatles songs, the way John said the lyrics came to him just like that, you know, it was like,
wasn't he dreaming and it kind of forced him out of bed? I think that's what I read from your book.
He said he was, writing, I don't know if it was that one. Yeah. The lyrics came to him while he was in bed. Same thing with, Nowhere Man. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's coming to him and then they can't get it out fast enough. They can't get it on the paper fast enough. Paul said the same thing about Yesterday and about Let It Be. The Let It Be definitely came as a dream, and that was his mother giving him that advice, Mother Mary being his mother, not Mother of God, which a lot of people made that assumption.
Yes.
But so Paul said it felt like a visitation when he did Let It Be. And Yesterday, he really questioned whether he had plagiarized it, because it was like, that isn't something he normally would have written. So I think that they were able to tap into that source of inspiration. And I know, Eric Myers in his book, The Spiritual Dimension of the Beatles, talked a lot about Paul's mother and John's mother being their muses, and that a lot of the inspiration was actually coming from them. So I found the process really interesting to me, because like I said, as a creative person, you know, you're trying to understand where is my source of inspiration, because you know, this is not how you would do it if you were in a conscious state. Writing in a conscious state is completely different than what's coming out of you when you're in this altered state of consciousness. So,
well, as you quote in the book, you quote Mozart, who wrote, "Whence and how these ideas come, I know not, nor can I force them." And then Paul said, the great thing about Yesterday is that kind of wrote itself. People say to me, do you believe in mysticism or magic? With that story, I kind of have to.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that's available to just about anybody. To be able to write like that, you don't really need to be, a McCartney or a Lennon or a Stephen King or, Richard Bach or anybody like that. You can tap into that. That's like part of our birthright as souls. So I do teach that to people, how to do that. That actually was my thesis for my master's degree, was soul writing. Cause I think as a transformational tool, it's exceptional in helping people to, understand what's going on in their lives and get some guidance.
I see some parallels to mystical Christianity. And one of the ones I love the most, and I actually wrote about this in a book that I wrote, and it's a quote from I Am the Walrus. I am he, as you are me, and we are all together. That's as mystical a statement as I think you're going to find anywhere. And I noticed that it parallels John 14:20. I am in my Father, and you are in me, and I in you. So there is that mystical oneness, whether they're saying it directly or not. And it's probably best not to say it, because mysticism's got more baggage than any other word in the English language, right? As soon as you start using that word, you're going to probably get into some trouble. Yeah. But there was that whole notion of oneness, Beatles oneness, Christian oneness, kind of the same there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that we, on some subliminal level, we picked up on that and we kind of embraced it and held it to ourselves. So, but like I said, a lot of that didn't happen until they were long gone. And that's an interesting part of all of this. It was like, it wasn't instantaneous, for many of us. Now, I'm not saying everybody was like that, but I know for me, it wasn't.
You know, it's interesting, Joanne, when you look back at the Beatles discography, you realize that even though the fans may not have been aware of the fact that they were going to be breaking up, the Beatles left a number of hints. I mean, Across the Universe had that kind of, deeply emotive spiritual quality that suggested an end was near. I mean, the end off of Abbey Road. And of course, the quintessential let it be. I mean, I think Paul had a dream from his mom that basically said, I know this is tough, son, but just let it be.
Just let it be. Yeah, right. Exactly. Totally. Totally. Well, we were hearing rumors for quite a while. I was waiting for some official notice from the club in New York to tell us what was going on. And when Paul left the group, we thought, well, maybe it's a temporary thing. You know, maybe it's like it's a family and they just had a little bit of a spat, but it's okay. They'll be back. You know, we could see the writing on the wall, you know, when Yoko came into the picture, when Linda came into the picture, I mean, we knew things were not the same. I mean, we could see that. And yeah, Let It Be was the big wake up call. But what was happening was what happened in the end was that George Harrison got a copy of the newsletter that his fan club put out. And to this day, none of us really know what it was that was in there that bothered him so much, because that was one of the best fan clubs in the country. The president of that fan club was friends of the family, and had a good relationship with George's father and his sister. That club started a fund for Bangladesh. They sponsored a child in Thailand. They had something for the Cancer Association. So they were doing a lot of good stuff. But something in that newsletter, particular newsletter, George just hit the roof, which of all the Beatles for this to happen to, it's ironic that it was George. And he just had a meeting in London, and he said, why is this happening? There are no more Beatles. There should not be any more Beatle fan clubs. And of course, Alan Klein, who hated the fan clubs in the first place, you know, he sort of got called on the carpet, and he then, you know, contacted the president of the National Club, called her into his office and said, what is this? I thought there are no more Beatles. There shouldn't have been any more Beatle fan clubs. And so that we got the order to, that we were going to be disbanding. Now they tried to save the fan club by forming a club called the Apple Tree. And that was meant to be for any artist under Apple Records. So in that way they could keep Paul and they could keep John and George, you know, because they were still recording under Apple. But that didn't last very long. They disbanded the club in England. One of the premier magazines that used to be published was called Beatles Monthly. That stopped being published. And we were told, you know, that's it, kids. So what happened was, ironically, a lot of the fan clubs that wanted to continue, even after being told they, you know, you can't, went back to their independent status that they had before all this chapter stuff went on. So, but I wasn't one of them. I felt that I had had enough.
And at that point you were 20, right? And so, I mean, some of the people coming in, the kids coming in, you know, you almost couldn't be on the same plane.
No, I had a couple of meetings at downtown Chicago hotels, and we would get several hundred people coming to those. And I even had a reporter from the Chicago Tribune come and cover it. So it was a big deal for someone who is as young as me to have organized this. But the group was getting younger and younger and younger. And when you're 20, you cannot relate to a 12, 13-year-old. And so we're wondering, where are all the older Beatle fans going? You know, what happened to everybody? And so, you know, eventually I decided I didn't really pull the plug till the Bangladesh experience, going to New York for that concert. We had been promised tickets by the National Club. They said they weren't going to give them to us, but they were going to allow us to buy them, and so we could all the fan club presidents, all of the area secretaries. Every state had an area secretary. We could come in if we wanted to, and we could all sit together, which is something we were looking forward to. So there were some people who went to New York without a ticket, thinking that a ticket was waiting. There were no tickets for us. They never had the tickets.
But you had a friend who had picked one up, right?
Luckily, I had a friend who got the tickets for me, so I was able to go to the concert. But it was also the first time for me that I stood in front of a hotel in which George and Ringo were staying, and I was like I felt like a groupie. You know, I was just kind of, and I didn't want to do it. I was always actually appalled at the thought that some fans would fly to England and stand in front of the Beatles' homes. I had one friend from New York who went and went all the way up to Scotland to his farm. And I thought, how can you do that? I cringed, you know, when I heard stories like that. I thought, that's such an imposition, you know. And so I would never do something like that. So the fact that I'm standing in front of at the Park Lane Hotel, and I'm standing there waiting to see a glimpse of one of the Beatles, you know, it really started to do something to me psychologically. And suddenly I'm replaying the last 8 years, you know, of all the money that I spent, the time that I put into it, the loss mm-hmm. of friendships over it. I wasn't focusing on anything positive at that moment, believe me. But and I thought to myself that I'm done. And so but I didn't have to be done, because shortly after that is when they disbanded anyway. So it was a way for me to gracefully bow out. Which my father was thrilled, because he just thought I was too old to be doing that anyway. But, you know, stopping the fan club, all of a sudden my whole life changed, because suddenly the phone wasn't ringing anymore. I wasn't getting any tons of mail like I used to. I was sort of lost for the longest time. And, you know, I finished college, you know, started a career, got married, had a family. And then it was 1987 comes along, and here comes Shirley MacLaine with Out on a Limb being a miniseries and talking about reincarnation. And that, you know, that put me on the track of becoming a reincarnation researcher and therapist and author. And so it brought me to who I am today.
And you probably went back and rediscovered some of those lost pearls amidst the Beatles' field of music, which did reference mysticism, which did reference reincarnation. And, you know, it's interesting. The Beatles in some ways have left us with a legacy, and whether we directly were involved, like you were with the fan club, or not, all of us have been impacted. Because when you think about it, today's largest or fastest growing religious group are the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, you know, the spiritual but not religious. And when you think about it, all four of them, to the degree they discussed it, had a perception of a God that was unlike anything in the West. George was a little bit more adhered to the East, but even people like John Lennon and Paul McCartney had very esoteric notions of what God is. I know you quoted it in your book. I had heard of what Lennon had said 3 days before he died, where he basically said, you know, we can move to an age where there's not a, you know, delineation between Christian and Jew, between Hindu and Islam. I mean, imagine this would be true religious freedom. And if there is a God, we're all it. We're all part of it. That's again, without calling it a mystical statement, it certainly would be heresy with Orthodox religions. But they were ahead of the curve once again, even though that happened after the Beatles broke up.
Yeah, and I found really interesting in doing my research is that a lot of what their thoughts about God and about religion began when they were quite young. Especially George, you know, was raised Catholic, but he didn't practice Catholicism. Same thing with Paul. George was just questioning it at a very young age. And I found that really interesting, because there was like this detachment that he was talking about. And I think what's ironic is that if people knew how they really felt about God when John made that statement about Christianity, maybe they wouldn't have been so critical of what he was saying. So, when I was doing my research, I went through about 60 different Beatle biographies, and I was astounded at the number of quotes that I found that had to do with mm-hmm. some esoteric belief. And then I was really even more surprised at John and Yoko and their involvement with numerology and tarot. And they had like a psychic on staff, you know, on call. And John was, studying Kundalini energy. And they did believe in reincarnation because John talked about that. They did had some Egyptian artifacts in their home. And I mean, there was a lot there that that the average fan really didn't know what was going on. But it all added up to, this constant evolution that they were going through, that we were sort of trailing behind a little bit. But nonetheless, we were doing it as well.
Well, when you think about it, Joanne, even though there had been forerunners before them, I'm thinking, Ralph Waldo Emerson and the Transcendentalists, Yogananda, Houston Smith, Aldous Huxley, introducing us to Vedanta, Eastern mysticism, Hinduism, Buddhism, but not until the Beatles come along is it mass, not produced, but, exclaimed. And it's only when they come along, and certainly with going to India with the Maharishi, that whole notion of that other hemisphere in our brains, in our world, now starts to connect with our Western rationality. And without the Beatles, that doesn't happen.
Right. And this, nothing's happened since then as far as that kind of an impact from a musical group, at least. I'm not sure. We were raised in a religion. I mean, like I told you, I was raised Catholic, but so I had some sort of a religious foundation, some sort of a belief, which I questioned, of course, but it was still nonetheless there. And then this opened a new road for me. It was like you come to the fork in the road and, which way are you going to go? And they're showing this whole other direction that we really mm-hmm. didn't know about or think about. And it transformed us. And if you read the comments from the Beatle fans in that one chapter in my book, it's not just me saying this, everybody else that I talked to that went through it, when I did not, they weren't the same coming out of it as they were going into it, that's for sure. So it was a very profound experience for all of us.
Just a comment or two before about the passing of Lennon and Harrison. I mean, both of them experienced violence. George before the end, but he had already contracted cancer. I'm not sure. He was stabbed in his home, I believe, in Maui, not in England. And then, of course, John dies the most violent of deaths of being shot. Yeah. In front of the Dakota. I don't know. Maybe they would have looked at this and said, hey, it was part of our karmic makeup, our karmic destiny.
I don't know. I think I've read that John was always worried about having an early death and that the psychics around him could see that was a possibility, but they never said anything to him because, they didn't want to add to his fears about it. I don't know. I mean, for George to leave at such a young age as well, both of them, it's a loss. It's a tremendous loss. I don't believe that we pick out our death in all the work that I've done in that area of life between life. I do think we have exit points that we say, I'm pretty much done here. I'm going to move on. Mm-hmm. And in moving on, maybe, at that, it generates a whole other set of experiences for people who are responding to that loss. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty awful. I was thinking about that the other day. I thought, okay, so if George didn't get cancer, would he still be with us? If John didn't move to New York, would he still be with us? You know, because the fact that we still have Ringo and Paul, what a blessing that is, you know, to be at their tremendous age and to still have, and they're still performing. God love them. Yeah.
I know. Have you seen McCartney? Have you ever seen McCartney in concert? You haven't.
No, I saw the four of them. I saw the four of them in concert twice. And I'm like happy.
Twice.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's like you can't top that.
Okay. No, that's yeah, absolutely true. So, you know, kind of as a final assessment, how does a young Catholic girl from the South Side of Chicago get engaged in so many esoteric philosophies? And what did the Beatles have to do with that?
Wow. You know, I think that this young girl was always searching. This young girl had a lot of questions and she was looking mm-hmm. for something. She really wanted to fill that hole, you know, and I think that she just did what she could to connect with others like her and eventually, you know, devoting all that time and energy to the Beatles, and developing some skill sets along the way, as president of a fan club, you know, to do a newsletter and to sell pictures and to organize meetings and stuff like that. And then just following them. And because I'm a writer, I started paying close attention to the words and it all fell together. It was like, okay, I had these questions about Catholicism and about spirituality, they're coming up with some ideas that, oh, they're answering those questions. They're providing me with clues. Now I can go and search a little deeper because they showed me the way to search. And so I think that, you know, as I say in the book, they truly, truly planted the seeds. And that's all George really wanted to do, is to mm-hmm. have planted those seeds to blossom in the rest of us at whatever time period the universe thought was appropriate for each of us. So yeah, I definitely see the connection between the two.
Joanne DiMaggio's latest book is The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. Go to her website, joannedimaggio.com. Joanne is actively engaged in teaching and training those who are interested in soul writing, meditative states, and how to channel that inner voice, and also conducts past life regression therapy. And as always, Joanne, we love having you here on New Thinking Aloud. So thank you for joining us this time.
Oh, thank you. I loved every minute of it.
For all of us here at New Thinking Aloud, for Emmy Vadnais, for longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove, all the great volunteers at NTA, I'm Christopher Naughton. Thanks for joining us this time. We'll catch you next time on New Thinking Aloud, because you, after all, are the reason that we're here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.